Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm the other guy.
And I'm Ken Rudin, and let me explain why Ron Elving is saying he's the other guy, because there was a tweet I received this week by someone who loved last week's podcast, the opening with the two old guys talking.
You finally got a tweet.
And that person said, I love the podcast with Ken Rudin and the other guy.
I do too. And let me just say that, Ken, this was the week we found out how few people love the two major parties in America. Fewer than ever identify with the Democrats or the Republicans. It's almost down to 50% of the people who would actually identify with either one.
Well, there's a new Washington Post poll out this week that shows 42% of Americans describe themselves as independents.
The shocking thing to me is that we're down to 33 for Democrats and only 20, one in five, right, willing to call themselves Republicans. And then this big, big number of independents, a plurality, well over 40%, saying they'd rather call themselves independents. Do you think they're really independent?
Well, I think what's happening is that Republicans who have been disillusioned with the party, perhaps moderates, perhaps people upset with the final years of the Bush administration, decided that being a Republican is not exactly the way they want to go, but they can't get to say that they're Democrats, and so they're independent.
They're parking at independent.
And as soon as something changes, they could very well wind up back in the GOP.
You know, I would also suggest there's another group, perhaps just as large, that is formerly Republican and does not consider the Republican Party to be sufficiently aggressive in representing their own conservatism. And so, as opposed to being moderates who feel the Republicans no longer represent them, they're actually people to the right of the conventional Republican Party who feel the party no longer represents them.
Two things that come to mind immediately. One is that if there were a Ross Perot at this time, at this juncture in political life, maybe this would be a great time for a third party, although we always say that and never happens. And two, we're seeing something in the elections that are coming up on November 3rd where third-party candidates could very well make a difference.
That's right, and I think that that's partly because people are interested in a third option, but it's also just plain dissatisfaction with the candidates we see, particularly in New Jersey, and also with the activities of the parties more generally. I think that the general energy politically in the country right now is more populist than it is partisan.
I agree with that. And if speaking of New Jersey, though, I mean, we see that Governor John Corzine, the Democrat, his numbers are atrocious.
They're terrible, and they haven't gotten better through this whole campaign. Even as the gap has closed, his numbers are still poor.
The last Quinnipiac poll we saw showed him with a 56% negative rating, and that's the best he's been in months.
I think they popped the champagne corks at his campaign headquarters.
And so what he does, and he's been doing very effectively, is look, the voters will never love me, so what I'll do is make sure the voters don't love my Republican opponent, Chris Christie.
Although there's a lot to love.
Therefore, we do see the spectacle of Chris Daggett, who is an independent candidate, who is approaching 20% in the polls.
And telling people, I can get 20%. I'm number three.
But if you look at the history of New Jersey gubernatorial elections,
and I do.
Oh, yes. You'll find nobody has ever done that well as a third.
There's never been a 20%.
No.
This is a Ross Perot level of support. He had 19% when he ran for president,
right,
in 1992. So this would possibly, and this is what everybody's waiting to see, tilt the election back to John Corzine if Christie continues on a downward slide and Corzine maintains this robust 39-40% of the poll. He could still get reelected.
Well, President Obama was there for him this week and campaigned for him. And basically, the argument was not so much what Corzine has done the past 4 years, but the fear of what Chris Christie and those Republicans who got us involved.
Republican. And if it's down to 20% nationally, you've got to figure it's not doing so well in New Jersey, a blue state.
Republicans had not elected a statewide official in New Jersey since 1997 when Christine Todd Whitman won her second term. And they haven't elected a Republican senator in New Jersey since 1972 with Clifford Case.
Good night. 1972?
Yeah.
That is 37 years ago.
What's my understanding? There'd be no math on this.
This is an extraordinary development, then, if we do have New Jersey on the brink of electing a Republican, even calling him a Republican, to this particular office. But I think we see the same sort of rejection of both parties going on in upstate New York in the 23rd House District.
And it's a different rejection because in New Jersey it may be rejection from Daggett may be attracting voters from the center or from the center left, whereas upstate, Doug Hoffman, the Conservative Party candidate, the third party candidate, is getting voters from the right who feel that Dee Dee Scozzafava, the Republican nominee, is just insufficiently conservative.
And a lot of that is about choice. A lot of that is about
gay rights, taxes.
And you have an array of Republican forces, and not just social conservatives, but you've got Dick Armey and some of his economic conservative people up there against her, Club for Growth against her, and for Doug Hoffman, of course. It really is an amazing statement on their part that they're prepared to separate conservatism from the Republican Party. And that, again, is why I think that when you see the Republican Party way reduced to 20%, it's because conservatives are abandoning the party, even as the party tries to identify itself more with conservatives.
Well, they could make the argument, the conservatives make the argument, that the party abandoned them first, the mainstream, the big spenders, the earmarks, all the stuff that went on for years unabated in the Bush administration. Suddenly, for the Republicans to say we're the party of small government, some conservatives say that that rings hollow.
Okay, now why isn't this operative then in Virginia, where you see the Republican candidate for governor, a conservative, more or less, I think, widening his lead, or at least maintaining a pretty solid lead over the Democratic candidate? Why isn't this Republican-conservative split visible in that state?
Well, because Bob McDonnell is conservative. Two, Cree Deeds may not be running the best campaign in the world. And three, it's perhaps 2008 was an aberration in Virginia where...
Well, no, wait a minute. You're talking about the Obama vote?
I am.
But they have two Democratic senators now who are center-left candidates, both of them. And
they
have had a succession of two, at least, governors in the state who were both Democrats.
Right.
And again, I would say center-left Democrats. Right. There's more than an aberration of 2008 going on in Virginia. Why isn't it helping Cree Deeds?
No, but I think the aberration was the fact that a huge African-American turnout for Barack Obama in 2008 that we're seeing not duplicated this year. And look, and the most important thing, perhaps, is the history involved. And we've said this over and over again, going back to 1977, the party in the White House loses the next year's governor in Virginia.
Okay, but that isn't necessarily anything other than a pattern that has repeated itself a number of times now and may actually have some meaning, but doesn't necessarily have to have meaning.
Doesn't have to explain why
it could be a coincidence. Right. It could be a function of other larger forces. And when you look at Virginia in the last several elections, they do seem to have made a decided move towards the Democratic Party, largely because of that Northern Virginia voting bloc, and it doesn't seem to be working for Cree Deeds. Is it just because he's not from Northern Virginia?
Well, also, I think McDonnell is running a very good campaign. Remember, George Allen and the famous Makaka comment in 2006...
started the big slide, really, in
not
many
only,
respects.
But he was hemorrhaging towards the end of the 2006 campaign, and yet he lost to Jim Webb by only a fraction of the vote.
But he had been a juggernaut in his moment.
He was the next
Republican.
Didn't
last very long, but a lot of people thought he was on his way to the 2008... Republican
he was
Party.
Measuring the drapes, right.
He was actually going to be nominated for president, and you could find a lot of people in Washington, D.C. who thought he was the next president.
But if you look at the kind of Republican candidates you've seen in the past in Virginia, Jerry Kilgore 4 years ago, the problems with Jim Gilmore for the Senate last time, they were not good candidates. I think a good part of this is McDonnell being a good candidate. My only point is that we're going to see a result on November 4th, or at least on the night of November 3rd, where I suspect the Republican wins in Virginia. It'll be really, really close in New Jersey, and Corzine could pull it out, and the Democrat will win it in New York 23. And what's the message? I don't know if there's a message there.
There probably is no clear message. There is no clear judgment on the part of the voters with respect to the parties, or for that matter, Barack Obama. It's a very divided public on all of those subjects, and they would prefer to have their freedom to call themselves whatever they want from day to day, and that's why the number of independents is going up. If they really are true independents, they do have a history, at least, of voting with one party or the other most of the time.
Now, you know there will be an attempt made on November 3rd to make this some kind of referendum one way or the other on Barack Obama.
Inevitably.
Right.
Inevitably. That's the easiest line to take, and we'll discuss it here in the podcast, and we'll discuss it on NPR, and everyone will talk about it. But it's entirely possible that the voters are going to just reject that analysis and give us something else entirely.
One person leaving Virginia, actually, is Kay Bailey Hutchison.
Goodbye, Kay.
We barely knew you.
I think it's sad. I actually thought Kay Bailey Hutchison brought a certain flavor to the Senate and that she was a particular kind of Republican and that in her day, a lot of people thought she was going to rise through the leadership and be the first woman who led either party in the Senate.
Well, this is very interesting because, first of all, 4 years ago, she announced she was going to run against Rick Perry for governor, and then she backed out at the last second. A lot of people thought she might do the same this year, announce and then back out. But by selling her house in Virginia, it shows she is intending to move back to Texas. She's going all out. But she also announced earlier this year that she would resign her Senate seat either in October or November. Now it looks like she may not do that at all.
Oh, really? that she might stay in the Senate she runs for governor. Well, you know, why not?
Right, exactly.
Why not stay? Why should she quit her job? She can certainly rent a place.
Which she will do.
And she could stay and finish out this Congress. And then, of course, either move into the governor's mansion if that becomes necessary or stay in the Senate. Well, why not continue to rise through, although she stepped off of the leadership ladder, she could continue to rise in the Senate if she so chose.
Well, many months ago when she announced the promise that she would leave, she was leading the polls, but evangelical conservatives have rallied behind Rick Perry. They really like him a lot. Now, he has a lot of problems with roads, with taxes, with infrastructure.
None of which vote.
With the death penalty. I mean, these are all serious issues that Rick Perry's going to have to address. But in the polls, in his March primary against Kay Bailey Hutchinson, he still has a lead. And so that may be why she's not giving up the Senate seat.
You know, I think she's a stronger candidate in the November 2010 election. And I think most people agree with that. But that's not the question. The question is, who do Republican primary voters like better? And I agree with you. I think Rick Perry at least has had a better fix on those people. Kay Bailey has not had a tough re-election battle or a tough primary battle in many, many years.
Ever.
And I think a lot of folks back in Texas have kind of forgotten where she is on the issues and can be told that she's a bit too liberal for Texas.
Well, she is very conservative. She is pro-life, but she's not pro-life in every aspect, whereas Rick Perry, I think, you know, is pro-life down the line.
Look, if she can be called a moderate on the choice issue, she can be called a liberal in Texas.
Right.
And that is exactly what Rick Perry and his people have been doing.
Right.
And that's what they're going to be doing.
But let's not forget, if you go back to 2006, the last time both candidates ran for anything, Kay Bailey Hutchinson was reelected with like 58 or 65% of the vote. Rick Perry, in a four-way race, got less than 40% of the vote. And so it showed that in the general election, as you say, Kay Bailey Hutchinson is more popular, but with the people who are going to vote on March 2nd, Rick Perry may have that advantage.
I believe that polls have shown consistently over a long period of time that Kay Bailey Hutchinson was the single most popular politician in Texas, more so than W. when he was president of the United States, and more so than Rick Perry. But that, again, is not the overall question. The question is just the hardcore come out for that primary next spring.
One battle that we've been watching in Washington this week is the White House with its interactions with Fox News. Obviously, we saw last month the specter of President Obama trying to sell his health care plan on five networks on Sunday morning, but not Fox News. We heard Anita Dunn say that, look, Fox News is a vehicle of the Republican Party.
An opponent of the president.
Yeah.
We're going to treat them like an opponent, she said.
And I think that's a little going too far. I think it's a little silly and childish of Barack Obama. What he's always done has been above the fray. He's been Mr. Cool. This doesn't seem like Mr. Cool to me. I think they've been rattled. And clearly Fox News has been looking for... itching for a fight. It's just that I didn't expect that the White House to fall down to that level and oblige them. But having said that, I just want to say on this podcast, I want the listener to know that I made a grievous error this week.
Not on the podcast.
No, no, that's impossible.
No, that's not possible.
Because this is not live, thank God.
But it isn't?
but I did say while I was expressing my disappointment in President Obama engaging with Fox News like that, I did say it reminds me of Richard Nixon's enemies list, and that is slightly ridiculous. It's very ridiculous.
Everyone knows you wouldn't possibly remember that.
Well, I remembered it, and I remembered what they did with the press, and I said, well, you know, if they're selecting Fox as their enemy, it reminds me of Richard Nixon. But Nixon harassed, intimidated, bugged. He violated the Constitution, what he did.
Burglarized.
Right.
And it was also not just one news organization.
It was many news organizations.
Although there was a particular animus for the Washington Post, that the Nixon people went after the Post because the Washington Post was investigating Watergate with, what were their names?
Woodstein and Burnwood.
Yes.
Right.
And because of that story, Ron Ziegler, the unforgettable press secretary of that era, singled out the Washington Post, singled out their editor, Ben Bradley, talked about them a great deal. I mean, that might be a better analogy to Obama's people going to war with Fox than the enemies list, which was a much more general assault.
But still, having said Nixon and Obama in the same sentence, I have been chagrined because we're talking about violations of the Constitution as opposed to peak. And there is a, I think there's a slight difference there.
Remembering the Watergate era, of course, brings to mind one of the giants of that era on the journalistic side, the Los Angeles Times reporter and columnist Jack Nelson.
And bureau chief for over 20 years. Jack Nelson is one of the giants. And not only we talk about Watergate, we talk about all the things he covered, but nobody, I think, did a better job investigating civil rights violations. He was a fearless reporter with the Atlanta Constitution and then later with the Los Angeles Times.
He was a native Southerner himself.
He was. He's from Alabama, and he knew... George Wallace used to, you know, just spill venom every time he would read a Jack Nelson column. He was also a great guy, but he was somebody that who really was fearless, stood up to the powers that be, and one of the things that I think journalism misses today, somebody like Jack Nelson.
Jack Nelson left us this week at the age of 80. And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR News.
Oh, every foe that ever I faced, the cause was there before we came. And every cause that ever I fought it full without regret or shame. But the dark does die as the curtain is drawn and somebody's eyes must meet the dawn. And if I see the day, I'd only have to stay. So I'll bid farewell in the night and be gone.